I think Frank Capra directed most of those films. So that was certainly a big influence on me, and I'm sure that has something to do.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Yes, we are on the air. 90.7 FM. WGXC, let me do the first, very first station ID. You are tuned to WGXC 90.7, servicing Accra, Catskill, and Hudson, Columbia and Greene County. Woo! Woo! Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes with the brooding ambient strains of Nadia Khan. Music from Sweden's Das Orchester, a glitchy sound poem from Dasha Rush, and a chilling jazz fugue by Leonard Bernstein. Deep Threes. Music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Dan Bunny of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Accra, Hudson, Catskill.
Hi, radio listeners.
WH2O.
Thank you.
Can you turn your radio down?
Hello?
Can you turn your radio down?
It's really hard to hear you, Al. Could you turn your radio down? Turn your radio down. Yeah, I heard you the first time.
Patrick, you turned the volume up. Turn it the other way.
What?
Sonar.
Sonar allows fishing boats to find and follow the shoals. Killer whale sonar allows them to keep their prey under surveillance in any conditions, including darkness or murky water. Fishermen and killer whales have shared these waters for centuries. Up until the mid-1900s, the whales always scooped the fishermen. They were faster than the boats and better at finding the fish. But all that changed when people discovered sonar. Now, the boats were able to turn the whales' own technique against them, and for a short time, the whales found themselves outcompeted by the fishermen. But that didn't last for long. Soon the whales understood that the behavior of the boats was a useful guide to the whereabouts of the herring. And because they don't need cumbersome nets, the whales can get in quick and grab some action ahead of the competition.
I want to talk a little bit about whale radio. Gregory Whitehead, radio artist, calls Captain Ahab of Moby Dick fame the first shock jock, as the scarred and hobbled lightning-struck captain rants his way through the pages of Moby Dick. Waving his harpoon at the stormy skies, filled with hate for the elusive whale, Ahab is struck by lightning, electrified, his peg leg tapping out a Morse code of vengeance across the deck. Ahab may be a forerunner to the big-mouthed, blasted broadcast radio hosts, who we will not name at this moment, but we can imagine who they are. But what of other pelagic metaphors to be found in this story? For instance, what of the great white whale? The interaction of human with whale in Moby Dick was not one of empathy or mercy, but one of mass slaughter. However, perverse moments of transcendence seem to have taken place on the human side of this most violent communication. The character of Ishmael narrates a famous and particularly tactile episode which takes place when he has been flensing the whales caught on the boat, an encounter with spermaceti, or the material inside the spermaceti organ, which is on the big melon head of sperm whales. And it enables echolocation and sound making in a sperm whale. So it's a gigantic organ filled with the spermaceti material. When flensing and rendering whales into oil upon the whaling ships, whalers had to squeeze the lumps out of the spermaceti, which Ishmael describes as a sweet and unctuous duty, enabling fellowship in close proximity. I will read this little famous passage. I squeezed that sperm till a strange sort of insanity overcame me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-laborers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, affectionate, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget, that I at last was continually squeezing their hands and looking up into their eyes sentimentally, as if to say, "Oh, my dear fellow beings, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities or know the slightest ill humor or envy? Come, let us squeeze hands all round. Nay, let us squeeze ourselves into each other. Let us squeeze ourselves universally into the very milk and sperm of kindness." So here the whale spermaceti, the actual stuff which allows sperm whales to echolocate and communicate, becomes a medium for human communication. Sadly, Ishmael's profound encounter with humans happens through the body of this slaughtered whale. But what if the whale proposed an alternate understanding of transmission in its own society that is entirely missing from this account? So recent studies of toothed whales and dolphins, let's see if I've got a little whale here, there we go. Toothed whales and dolphins, also known as odontocetes, pretty much all of the current whale research now discusses whales as having culture, as living in societies, as speaking languages and dialects. The brains of humpback whales, dolphins, orcas, sperm whales, and others are especially developed in areas of acoustic processing and communication intelligence. And researchers have been able to observe that they use very complex language, including very distinct dialects among different groups, even living in close proximity to one another. That they pass memories and knowledge on to subsequent generations through communal recollection, that they have self-consciousness, pardon me, complex coalition formation skills, and have been known to use tools. Sound travels more than four times more quickly in water than in air, and water is a particularly excellent medium for long-range transmission of low-frequency sounds. As a result, the use of echolocation and acoustic communication among whales and dolphins holds some surprising parallels to the notions of resonant transmission that I've been discussing with regard to radio. Sperm whale researchers describe being in the water near a group of sperms and feeling the pulses in their bones as they are echolocated from close range by the whales. And so too, dolphin researchers, such as Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff, they write, "When a dolphin turns toward you and explores you acoustically with echolocation, you may even feel the buzz of sound waves in your bones and muscles as you reveal more detailed aspects of your physiology to the dolphin by sound waves, more information than the eyes can see." Kind of like a little ultrasound, almost. These researchers speculate that such intimacy among whales enable the tight social formations and more extensive group consciousness that cetaceans exhibit, while long-range echolocation and sound-making allows whales to have an acute spatial sense in their surroundings. Thus, whales would seem to use sonic communications in ways that are physically, socially, and geographically resonant. says Peter Hoare, it was as if they were resounding miles below, even as they radioed their presence to other whales miles apart. Tuned into some unseen circuit of food and communal intent, they knew instinctively where they were, while we wonder constantly what on earth we are doing. That's regarding sperm whales hunting 2 miles below and making little echolocational sounds. Listening in on hydrophones, researcher Hal Whitehead notes that sperm whales grazing deep underwater keep a constant chorus of clicks. The jumble of clicks of a group of hunting sperms, which together sound like radio static. Sperms also produce recognizable codas, which Whitehead and others understand as signature sounds, dialects, or possibly musical elements involved in whale communication. Orcas, or killer whales, also use backscatter effects from echolocation to distinguish and hunt their favorite Chinook salmon among a school of other salmon. And spinner dolphins communally forage for and trap fish utilizing collective phonation, an ability by a group to sonically navigate as well as converse in low visibility waters with broadband clicks and focus bursts of sound. So really illuminating the landscape of the ocean as a group. In an even stronger and perhaps stranger radiophonic parallel, recent research by a dentist, actually, Martin Nguia, into the nature of narwhal tusks reveals that, the narwhal is this northern sort of small cetacean whale, where for a long time they thought that it was a horn coming out of the forehead of the narwhal, kind of like the unicorn whale, but in fact turns out that the tusk is a tooth that pierces, that grows through the lip, pierces the lip, and grows to be approximately 5 feet long. And they're mainly in the male whales, but some female whales grow these tusks as well. Anyway, for a while there was this idea that the tusk was a jousting tool, the males competing for the females, jousting in the northern seas. Well, of course, it turns out to be nonsense. That, in fact, the tusk is more like an antenna, surprisingly. Unlike other teeth, its surface has open tubules connected to inner nerves. It is, in effect, a giant sense organ, basically a tooth turned inside out with the sensitive part on the outside and the solid, strong part on the inside. It's lined with 10 million nerve endings to enable the animal to detect subtle changes in temperature and pressure. This may explain why narwhals raise their tusks above water as if to sniff the air. Other research indicates that the tusk is not only a sensory probe, but may also be a transmitter or receiver of sound and even of electricity. The narwhal tusk turns out to be, as I said, a tooth turned inside out, with all its sensitive sensing faculties at the surface and the hardest mineralized dentin deposits at the center, producing a spiraling tooth that is strong and flexible, if still mysterious. So whale radio? Are we talking about whale radio? It would seem to be a form of wireless which is both intimate and tactile, and promiscuous at long range. Entirely resonant, requiring the feedback loop of resounding to be meaningful, and requiring everyone in the circuit to both send and receive. Of course, whale radio relies on mechanical, not electromagnetic waves, but remains a really potent example. Could humans develop such capacities in such social life? Or could the example of whale radio temper the ethics of the technologies that we do develop in order to communicate at a distance? Can it challenge what we think communication is for, how long it takes, and what forms it takes?
Starving in the belly of a whale. private. Pay the gangsters, pay the fiddler. Sky is darkening, boats are parking. But the caravan moves on. You tell me who gives a good goddamn. You never get out alive. Don't go taming. The crooked old world. Starving in the belly of a whale. Oh, we're starving in the belly, starving in the belly, starving in the belly of a whale.
Rapidly hurtling towards a version of the post-human future which may have already destroyed the possibility of whales, much less allow for the possibility of humans to become more like whales. If aliens, whales, and the search for intelligent life in the universe and radio still seem like odd bedfellows, note this twist of fact. Let's return to the golden record. NASA's Voyager 1 and 2 space probes are just now passing through the edges of the solar system and lingering in heliopause. They use low-watt radio transmitters, transmitting in the 8 gigahertz range, or super high frequency, which are typically band waves that include microwave or WLAN or radar systems. And these transmitters send signals back to the Earth with a mere 23 watts of power. Your average pirate transmitter is usually stronger than that at 50 watts. The Voyagers were famously outfitted with the Golden Record, a phonograph record inscribed with sounds from Earth, also curated by Carl Sagan, as well as greetings in many languages, music from different cultural traditions, field recordings of weather, animals, fighter jets taking off, and neural signatures from human brain activity. The record also includes recordings of humpback whale songs. Some mechanical parts on these probes are also lubricated by sperm whale oil, by spermaceti, in order to keep the mechanical parts moving under such low temperature and high pressure conditions. I have a quote again from Philip Hoare. One scientist who sailed with whaling fleets in the 1950s and 60s told me that it was only when it had a lifetime supply of oil, I imagine marked barrels sitting in some secret cellar, that America lobbied for a ban on hunting sperm whales, despite protests from the Pentagon. I've tried to follow that up, actually, and it's kind of impossible to find real confirmation of this, but I do know someone who worked for NASA in the 1960s on the Apollo missions, and he said it was quite likely that at least at that time sperm whale oil was still being used as a lubricant. Is it ironic or just tragic that Moby Dick was slaughtered in order for human shock jocks to send a message of mammalian presence and human exceptionalism into outer space? And whining about how we are so alone and there is nothing intelligent for us to meet or speak to? Surely it is indicative that the potential to encounter other terrestrial intelligence has very nearly been squandered in the service of more instrumental dreams of contact. So resonant radio could be a way to rethink or deepen what we think radio is for. Resonant radio could be something truly micro-local or something incredibly long-form. The question of how to reframe radio outside the broadcast paradigm might be answered by variations far outside the programming grid, outside of radio conceived as a signal filled with content. At a conference on the topic of alternative forms of exchange at Queen's University in 2008, Greg Younging raised the question, how can something be owned which is constantly changing? Here he was referring to indigenous people's perspectives on creativity and culture, particularly with regard to cultural objects and customs, and proposing not ownership but custodianship over lands, language, songs, dances, and symbols. Younging's emphasis was on an extended sense of time, one that exceeds the human scale without alienating the human from it. Communication takes generations, is about generations. Creative expression in this model is not individualistic, but time-based and held in common, and stems from continuous, though changing, relationships with culture and landscape through language and through physical life. Western culture, particularly under late capitalism, proposes not only that everything can be owned, but bought and sold as well. The electromagnetic spectrum, which includes the areas of radioactivity, AM, FM, shortwave frequencies, and all the rest, is as ever a growing real estate assigned to mobile communications networks, is a political as much as scientific construct designed to control inappropriate transmissions through frequency allocation and licensing. Even independent radio and often online radio, for all our progressive mandates, are bound by broadcast expectations, which understand radio as the manufacture and dissemination of a certain kind of programming day. So what kind of radiophonic relationships might we sustain across time if we think of radio as more than point-to-point communications on licensed frequencies, more than a format to migrate into the ever-personalized world of internet listening? It's a big step to declare that anyone can make radio. How do we move towards we are making radio together without predetermining who we are or what radio could be? Declaring ownership over such oscillating territories perpetuates the relentless workings of colonialism that have consistently worked towards conquest rather than collaboration or custodianship. The alternative potentials of radio that independent and clandestine practitioners have held in common begins to reimagine broadcast communication and the promise for community within the radio spectrum. Likewise, at this conference, we have often discussed and demonstrated how the simple reuse of unlicensed transmitters to explore and play with the materiality of electromagnetic waves has the potential to reimagine radio as much more than a medium for data transfer, but as a time-based expression of space itself. As whale radio might also suggest, the notion of radio shifts from a radiant means of communication to a resonant, though unstable, environment that is immersive, palpable, and effective, at play in an ocean of sonorous and sibilant waves that is an index of relationships, both microscopic and cosmic in scale, with which humans may collaborate, but which we cannot claim to own. Think of sperm whales deep underwater, their clicks like static, making up complicated rhythms that communicate and complement one another while they hunt and eat giant squid. Think of humpback whales performing the sonic equivalent of illuminating the entire Atlantic basin with the resonance of their songs. Think of teeth as antenna. Distance could be measured in miles or in the difference between one being and another. Resonance is about hearing distance, listening for difference, however micro or macroscopic. Many to many, listening for each other.
Darkness of the sea. Whales and dolphins depend on hearing to survive. But human technology is now invading their world. Military sonar used by the U.S. and other navies to locate submarines can emit noise as loud as a rocket blast. We are destroying life with sound. Bahamas, March, Canaries, September 2000. Washington State, May 2003. January 2005. The death toll continues.
Thank you. Your sperm whales communicate with each other using elaborate pricking patterns. And they can project these patterns over vast distances in the ocean. And they use them to talk to each other about the weather and various feeding grounds and the best routes and navigation. But because the ocean is so noisy now with all the information that travels underwater, it's easy for the whales' patterns to get drowned out. And if the whales can't hear the patterns, they lose all their sense of direction. And they just start to get lost. For example, young sperm whales that spend the summer up near Norway start to migrate back down south. But if they can't hear the directions clearly, they take the left turn too early, and instead of going out into the Atlantic, they start to swim down the English Channel, and they get beached on the shore. You know, there are a lot of things about sperm whales that never get explained in Nogatik. Like why sperm whales are called sperm whales. And the reason is that in the 15th century, some French farmers found a beached whale. And they cut off his head. And inside, they found about 1,000 pounds of this oily white stuff. And they assumed for some reason that this must be the whale's sperm. Although what 1,000 pounds of sperm would be doing stored in the whale's head remains something of a mystery to them. As for the great whales themselves, they swim in the sea. Enormous caravans led by the old bull man. And when this bull man is past his prime, he splits off from the herd. And he becomes a kind of loner. And he starts to swim in wide, irregular circles, talking to himself. Like the last man in a flooded world.
Wait a minute! Somebody's jamming our signal! What evil genius would do this?
We'll be right back. I don't half understand ye. What's in the wind?
Yes, yes, round the Cape of Good Hope is the shortest way to Nantucket, soliloquized Starbuck suddenly, heedless of Stubb's question. The gale that now hammers at us to stave us, we can turn it into a fair wind that will drive us towards home. Yonder to windward is all blackness of doom, but to leeward, homeward, I see it lightens up there, but not with the lightning. At that moment, in one of the intervals of profound darkness, following the flashes, a voice was heard at his side, and almost at the same instant a volley of thunder peals rolled overhead. "Who's there?" "Old Thunder," said Ahab, groping his way along the bulwarks to his pivot-hole, but suddenly finding his path made plain to him by elbowed lances of fire. Now, as the lightning rod to a spire on shore is intended to carry off the perilous fluid into the soil, so the kindred rod which at sea some ships carry to each mast is intended to conduct it into the water. But as this conductor must descend to considerable depth, that its end may avoid all contact with the hull, and as, moreover, if kept constantly towing there, it would be liable to many mishaps, besides interfering not a little with some of the rigging, and more or less impeding the vessel's way in the water, because of all this, the lower parts of a ship's lightning rods are not always overboard, but are generally made in long, slender links, so as to be the more readily hauled up into the chains outside, or thrown down into the sea, as occasion may require. "The rods! The rods!" cried Starbuck to the crew, suddenly admonished to vigilance by the vivid lightning that had just been darting flambeaux to light Ahab to his post. "Are they overboard? Drop them over, fore and aft! Quick!" "Avast!" cried Ahab. "Let's have fair play here, though we be the weaker side. Yet I'll contribute to raise rods on the Himalayas and Andes, that all the world may be secured, but out on privileges. Let them be, sir."
"Look aloft," cried Starbuck. "The corpusants! The corpusants!"
All the yardarms were tipped with a pallid fire, and, touched at each tri-pointed lightning rod end with three tapering white flames, each of the three tall masts was silently burning in that sulphurous air, like three gigantic wax tapers before an altar.
Pistol shrimp is no bigger than your finger, and it's a crack shot. One of its two claws functions just like a handgun, and other shrimp are targets. When prey is in range, the claw is cocked. The claw snaps shut so fast, it fires a bubble bullet up to 62 miles an hour. The bubble bursts and stuns the prey. It all happens in a fraction of a second. The fastest gun in the sea.
You are listening to WGXC.
Tune in at 6 p.m.
and at 7 o'clock a.m.
For all together now.
For local news.
The weather and school closing.
For interview with neighbors and friends.
And you might even hear us.
The Campaign Medium Group on
All Together Now!
Muelle Stéphanie, je m'appelle.
Thank you. You're listening to the radio WGXC Acre at 90.7 FM. This is Catskills' Ross Goldstein playing the Mellotron and Catskills' Brian DeWan playing the pipe organ live at Epsilon Spires in Vermont on the radio at WGXC Acre at 90.7 FM.